Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We all live in political boundaries called districts, determining the choices we have in voting for Congress, State House, State Senate, and Executive Council. The boundary lines themselves are drawn in a process called redistricting that happens every 10 years after the census is completed. In most states, the legislature runs the show, but recently, there's a lot of conversation nationally about whether that should change, including here in the Granite State. A bill making its way through our legislature would hand over the line drawing to an independent commission, an approach adopted by a handful of other states. Today in The Exchange, we find out more, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So we'll begin with the wider trends in redistricting, and then we'll turn to the pros and cons of this particular bill. Joining us now for this first segment are Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director. In 2016, Dan reported on how New Hampshire's state Senate districts have been drawn using new redistricting analysis tools that we'll hear about. Dan, great to see you. Thank you for helping us out.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Wendy Underhill, director of the National Conference of State Legislatures Elections and Redistricting Team. Wendy joins us from Colorado. Wendy, thank you for getting up early. We appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Glad to be with you.
Well, Wendy, just to start off, what is gerrymandering? Where does this term come from, and how prevalent is it?
Well, I think that the term gerrymandering is used by some people to refer to what other people might call a well-constructed redistricting plan. So gerrymandering is really just slang for redistricting, but it does have a little extra piece there to indicate that the person using that word thinks that the maps have been drawn to favor one group or another. It could be a racial group or it could be a political party. But it could be almost interchangeable, gerrymandering and redistricting. And as you said, redistricting is the rebalancing of these electoral districts for Congress or for state legislature. We want them to have the same population. As people move around, population shifts in a state. So every 10 years, you've got to rebalance. And that's what redistricting is. And if you want to call it gerrymandering, let's do it.
Well, so redistricting is the pure form of this process, redrawing these lines based on new census numbers. Gerrymandering, then, Wendy, seems to imply when the process goes awry and favors one over the other.
That's right. And those who like the plan don't call it that, and those who don't like the plan use the word gerrymandering.
So what's behind this push around the country, Wendy, for independent commissions? Legislatures have drawn these districts forever, so how come change it now?
You're absolutely right. By far, the legislature is the normal, standard, long-standing, traditional place where redistricting is done, and there has been a move towards shifting away from that. But mostly it's been kind of a slow move, one or two states per decade until just now. And this decade, between 2011 and now, six states have moved in that direction with some kind of major change to how they either who does redistricting or some combination of who does redistricting. So I do think we can say that there's a big shift this decade, but it's still measured in half a dozen states. So we're not talking about the whole nation is going in this direction. And right now, just to give you kind of the overline, 14 states use a commission to do their legislative lines, and six or seven use a commission to do their congressional lines. So
that's interesting. Why the split, Wendy? That is interesting. So 14 use an independent commission for legislative lines, and I think you said six do it for congressional lines. Why the difference there?
Well, one idea is that legislatures might like to maintain the responsibility for drawing their congressional district lines. It's a way that they can have a role in the federal government. It's a way to have their federal representatives pay a close attention to what's going on in the state legislature or in the state. And another way to think of it is that if you are using the line of thought that you shouldn't draw your own lines, but that's like being the referee for yourself, then passing off legislative line drawing makes more sense than passing off congressional line drawing.
So, Dan Barrick, we only have two congressional districts here in New Hampshire. What are the lines worth watching in this state?
You're right. In New Hampshire, the conversation around redistricting and gerrymandering hasn't really focused much on our congressional districts simply because there's only one line to draw to cut the state in half. The state house has really been the place where a lot of folks have raised some concerns about the process there. Both the state senate, the House of Representatives, and the executive council, which are three separate maps. We, as you mentioned at the top, at NHPR, the newsroom a few years ago, we decided to take a closer look at the impact of redistricting and gerrymandering on state politics here. We focused on the state senate for a number of reasons. One, it's relatively manageable compared to, say, the House of Representatives, the New Hampshire House, which includes 400 members and districts that sometimes overlap and sometimes include multi-members. The state senate is a fairly fairly discrete body. We used a method that has come into vogue in recent years in trying to assess the partisan imbalance of districts by counting the disparity between the number of votes over above what it would take to win a majority and how those votes might be allocated to kind of shift partisanship. And we used that calculation and found with few exceptions over the last few election cycles, New Hampshire state Senate districts have been drawn to give a partisan advantage to Republicans. So that if you look at what the actual popular vote is per district in a given election, and sort of project that to what that vote total might be expected to yield in terms of partisan breakdown in the number of seats each party has, that again, with few exceptions, Republicans are making out better. Now, the times when it seems that advantage is erased tends to be in wave election year, so where Democrats have had huge wins. Think the 2006 election or the 08 election where President Obama's first election, and in fact, the most recent election in 18. But in sort of average, so-called average election years, especially over the last decade since the last map was drawn, 2012, 14, and 16, Republicans in New Hampshire, in the New Hampshire Senate at least, were allocated a representation in the Senate that was in disproportion to what the actual popular vote was. Now, there's a number of reasons for that. I'm sure we'll get into it. But it is largely because, like the rest of America, redistricting and the process, the every decade process of drawing maps in New Hampshire has been a partisan process. It's been a political process. It's been handled in the legislature by the majority party, and the results sort of explain sort of give you an example of what that looks like.
So Dan, to you first, but Wendy, I want to hear from you as well. Dan, how has our more recent ability to really crunch lots of data all at once affected the ability to draw these districts very distinctly? Well, there's all these new analysis tools that people use.
Wendy could probably speak better at a national level. I know, you know, in New Hampshire, we only do it every 10 years like the rest of the country, and there hasn't been in some states there have been ongoing court battles where they've had to make new maps more recently. The maps we have in place for all of our congressional and state house level have been in effect, I believe, since 2011 or 2012. I believe my understanding is that the computational power has advanced quite significantly. Rick could probably speak to this later, but you know, in our interviews with the folks who were involved, you know, they kind of did it in part the old-fashioned way. They blow up a giant map of the state and cut it up into pieces and put the number of the population per town in a way. And in some ways, at least the way it was described to us in the reporting of this, it was sort of, you know, old-fashioned bare-knuckled politics where legislators would say, well, I really need that town to keep my, you know, that I can't let go of that town. What are you going to give me if you take that town away from my district? So it's very, it was handled in a, you know, sort of very personal kind of way. Now, you know, obviously a lot of the proposals on the table, both in New Hampshire and nationally, would seek to eliminate that kind of personalization of district drawing and really make it more mathematical and impartial.
I'd love to be in the room for some of those conversations. So, Wendy, what about the new mathematical tools that we have to draw districts, for better or for worse?
Well, the Moneyball effect, I'd say, hit politics long before it hit baseball. So data has been sort of at the core of redistricting for some decades. I think before we had the fancy software and that could slice and dice so carefully, we still had redistrictors who could do it maybe longhand, and they used acetate over a paper map to draw these things. So in some ways, I feel like the data's been there for several decades at the census block level, which is really, really a tiny piece of geography, and people have been doing it whatever the software was. One change that's taken place, though, is that new software is now available to the public sometimes to draw maps, and so there's that sort of shift. But I want to, if I could, just say something about what Dan said. And his analysis showed that the maps drawn in New Hampshire were favoring to Republicans, and I don't have reason to doubt that math at all, but I think that both the Senate and the House in New Hampshire did shift to Democratic control in 2018. That might get to your point about it being a wave election, but I guess my point is that redistricting doesn't determine who serves. Elections do at the end of the day.
How do, Wendy, the independent commissions in the few states that have them approach their work? How do they get started?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there's just so many different variations. I mean, it's like going to a taco bar, and what do you want on your commission? And so I guess what I'd say is that one of the things is, how do you want your commissioners to be selected? Is there going to be a piece of randomness in it after candidates have been vetted to make sure that they're qualified to serve and have the analytical skills they might need? Is there a randomness of literally picking some names? Do you want those folks who are going to serve to be, let's say, for Democrats, for Republicans, and for people who don't affiliate? That's how Colorado set its up recently. So that's a variation that can come into play. But maybe the biggest one is, are you going to create a commission that actually draws the maps and those maps become law? Or are you going to have it be an advisory commission where they draw the maps and then they submit them to the legislature for approval? And that's what Utah did this last year. Sometimes you don't need a constitutional amendment if you're going to go in that direction. And in the Utah case, if the legislature chooses not to take what the commission suggested, then they have to have a reason for why they didn't do it that way. So primary versus advisory is kind of important, and then how do the people get on there? And then from there, there's still a whole bunch of other stuff. We're thinking of creating a decision tree for legislators who are considering changing redistricting, because there's so many places that you can go fine points about how you're going to do the job.
Just one or two more last questions for the both of you, and then we're going to turn to the particulars of the independent commission bill here in New Hampshire. Dan, your analysis of state Senate districts, which we put on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, looked at the state Senate. What about the executive council, Dan? Did you look at that a little bit? Five executive council districts, some of them pretty funny shapes.
Yeah, no, certainly. We didn't do any analysis of the council, but that has been for folks who are critical of the process in New Hampshire. There is an undeniable gerrymander that exists there now. There's one district in particular that was clearly drawn to kind of pack as many Democratic-leaning cities and towns into as possible. It stretches from the seacoast, the Dover area, all the way west through Concord into Keene, basically from the Maine border to the Vermont border.
Wow, a district from Dover to Keene.
Yeah, and that's and sort of the language of redistricting is that it should include communities of sort of like interest or similar interest, and a few people would argue that there's a lot of cross traffic between Dover and Keene. So that's certainly an example, but it also it's got one of those sort of classic gerrymander shapes that people like to sort of pull out and
looks like a lizard,
like looking
or
at clouds
a worm
and trying to imagine
something.
What you can see. Yeah, so that makes sort of an easy icon for folks who are trying to get attention to this issue.
Real quick, Dan, you mentioned that district in the executive council looks like an attempt to pack Democratic votes into one district. This gets to one of those new analytical tools, right, Dan, called pack and crack. So can you just briefly explain what that means?
Right. So, for a candidate to win an election in a district, all they need to do is win 50% of the votes plus one. So any votes up and above that are, in a sense, wasted. So if you win a district by 51% or 99%, that's still just one seat. So if you can pack more of that candidates, or that you know, the theory is that candidates, voters who support, who lean towards that candidate's party into one district, you're essentially wasting those voters because they're just supporting a candidate who's going to win anyway. So that's largely the approach. And it gets at, you know, talking about getting rid of gerrymandering, the implication is not that the makeup of a legislative body should perfectly reflect the total vote aggregate, the voter aggregate. So say we've got a state senate of 10 seats, say, and Republicans win 60% of the vote and Democrats win 40%. It's not to say that a perfect, you know, ideally the only fair map is one in which Republicans have 6 seats and Democrats have 4. When you're looking at gerrymandering, what you're really looking at is, are the districts drawn in such a way to purposefully swing for one party? That, you know, it's not about perfect representation that reflects the vote total, but it's about drawing districts in such a way that are designed to give a clear partisan advantage to one party or the other.
Sure, because any given year, Dan, there's going to be maybe one candidate who's more compelling, or maybe voters from one party are just feeling less enthusiastic. And so there's a number of variables.
And voters self-sort. You know, voters are not distributed evenly across the state. Every town in New Hampshire does not represent the political makeup of the state as a whole. So there is going to be some districts that are always going to be Democratic or Republican, maybe by a very, because you just can't, you know, especially if they're in a denser urban area. But it's more about just trying to understand the partisan intent or any kind of intent that gives advantage or disadvantage to one group or another.
Wendy, are there any agreed upon best practices when it comes to drawing the best district possible?
Oh, that is such a great question. And I hate to say, but there's 50 ways to do this because there's 50 states. So it's really hard to describe. But I think the first thing states have to think about is who's going to do the work. Would it be a commission? Would it be the legislature? And then what are the standards or the criteria or the principles that they're going to use? So we've already said that they need to be balanced in terms of population, but you could also have a standard that says, I should also add that they must comply with the Voting Rights Act, which means nothing related to elections can be racially discriminatory. Then when you get past those two things, then states can adopt what are their criteria, and most of them adopt compactness and contiguity, meaning you can't have any donuts, you can't have a donut hole somewhere else. And then there are these questions about whether you want to put into your constitution or into your statute that you want to create competitive districts. If you do put that in, then you're going to probably go to court to figure out what does competitive mean, what's the definition of that, how do you know if you've done it. You could also say that you're not going to use political data, in which case the kind of packing and cracking that Dan described is harder to do if you don't know how people vote, and there are some states that do that. You could also use a new phrase. It's called neither favor nor disfavor. That's kind of becoming a little bit of a buzz phrase. Neither favor nor disfavor a political party or any candidate, and that means that you're not paying attention so much to the political side. And I can't say that those are necessarily best practices, but those are sort of things that are in the zeitgeist right now.
Things that
about
people are talking about.
Yeah,
so, Wendy, just to close out with you, what else are you having your eye on as states move forward with redistricting, no matter how they do it? And how do you see this whole discussion around independent commissions as part of our larger national conversation around elections and voting rights and so forth?
Well, I do want to say that there's another place that states are making changes, and this could be in a commission or in the legislature, and that's in regard to how do they gather public input and how do they keep the public informed of what's going on. It used to be something that was just done in the legislature, and you had to know when those hearings were and come on down. Well, now there's a lot more about how to get the word out and have hearings throughout the state. And particularly, some states are moving to where citizens can submit plans for consideration. So that's an area where I think there's more change. And then I think a lot of states, well, all the states really, are waiting to see how the Supreme Court comes down on two partisan gerrymandering cases that are going to be decided in June. And the question will be, do they find a standard that says that some amount of partisanship is too much and therefore unconstitutional? Right now, there isn't a standard to that effect. Did I answer everything, Laura?
You did, yes. And I had forgotten about those cases before the U.S. Supreme Court will be decided in June. It's hard to believe it's almost June. So
yeah, yeah,
we will get some decision on that soon. Dan Barrick, last question for you, please. How is our newsroom going to be covering this redistricting process, no matter what happens with this bill that we're going to talk about?
Well, we'll obviously be following the progress of the bill because that will really set the terms for the process. I think a lot will depend, too, on the outcome of the 2020 elections, because as you know, the current process now is that the majority party sets the terms as they do with any bill. And, you know, of course, New Hampshire is still very much a swing state. You know, Hillary Clinton won the presidential race here, but only by, you know, less than 0.5%. So that will set the terms for the process. And, you know, even if a redistricting commission and independent commission of some kind does become law this session, I think it'll be interesting to see how it's implemented in, you know, and which party's in control of the legislature in the process and how they decide to abide with the details of allocating that commission and letting it do its work. So that for us, at least, that will really dictate how we think and you know, what the outcome will be, obviously.
All right. Well, Wendy Underhill, good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're most welcome.
That's Wendy Underhill, director of the National Conference of State Legislatures Elections and Redistricting Team. Dan Barrick, thank you for helping us out. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Laura.
Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director. If you want to look at the analysis that Dan and his team did on state Senate districts back in 2016, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So coming up, we will look at this bill that we've been talking about, making its way through the legislature to establish this independent commission. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, who gets to draw the districts? In most states, the legislature creates political boundaries that determine elections. But this year, a bill at our state house would hand over most of that power to an independent commission. It reflects, as we heard in our last segment, a small but growing trend of more states debating whether to take elected officials out of the redistricting process. Again, we looked at that movement in our first segment. We're going to turn now to the particulars of the proposal here in the state. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Rick Lehman, a lawyer in Manchester who served as the legal counsel to the New Hampshire Senate from 2001 to 2005 and again from 2010 to 2018. And Rick Lehman, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Marjorie Smith, Democratic representative from Durham, chair of the House Judiciary Committee. She sponsored HB 706, which, as I said, would establish that independent commission. And Representative Smith, nice to see you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Delighted to be here.
So we'll get into the details in a moment, Representative Smith, but what's the bigger goal that you're trying to achieve?
The biggest goal, the most important goal, is to make sure that the people who we elect represent the state or the district that is occupied by people of varied interests, varied concerns. People always use politics and partisan in the same sentence. But politics does not have to be partisan. In this case, politics is really trying to say, how can we have a representative government that's fair and reflects the interests and concerns of the people of the state?
And as Wendy Underhill told us in the earlier segment, these independent commissions come out of a concern that the lines right now are, quote unquote, gerrymandered. Do you think the lines here in New Hampshire, Representative Smith, are gerrymandered, drawn to gain partisan advantage?
I think that in large measure they have been. In the year 2000, I was starting my third term in the legislature, and I was asked to serve on the redistricting commission. I was young and naive enough to think that was an honor. I will never again do such a thing. It was an abomination in terms of sitting and watching what was going on. Picture a pie. And we have had a district in the Senate in which slice number one of the pie and slice number three of the pie ended up being one senatorial district. Slice number two in the middle was in another. Those two slice number 1 and 3 were Dover and Durham. The only place they met was in the middle of water. That was not compact. It was not contiguous. It did not in any way show any fairness. But it was designed in order to make sure that we could largely predict which party would win one of those seats or another.
Dover and Durham being more liberal towns, so the idea is packing Democratic votes into that one district.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And in that year, there was a difference in party between the legislature and the governor. And the majority party wanted to see if they could come up with a system which would leave the governor out of it. The governor would not have to sign the bill. And so they proposed at one point that it be done by resolution. Resolution is what we do when we want to honor the Eagle Scouts, for example. Somehow deciding legislative districts seemed, as important as Eagle Scouts are, it seemed a little more important to have a system that, in fact, honored the House, the Senate, and the governor. That year, went to the courts.
I remember
spent
that.
Spent an enormous amount of money and time, had to delay the whole process for when candidates could register, and it was all because it was a partisan fight.
So, Rick Layman, two questions for you. First of all, the broader goal that Representative Smith talks about and that we heard about in the first segment, people feel like the system isn't fair, it's gerrymandered. I wonder how you perceive the way we draw the districts right now.
Well, I think the way we draw the districts is the way we're required to do it by our Constitution, which says in plain language that it's the responsibility of the legislature to do it. And as long as that's what our Constitution says, it's going to be the responsibility of the legislature to do it. So in the first instance, that's how we're required to do it. We don't have a choice at this point.
That's what our federal and state constitutions say, or the state constitution?
The state constitution.
Yeah. Do you see right now the districts drawn as a way to favor, at this point, the Republican Party, since Republicans were in charge in 2010?
I don't think they're drawn primarily to favor one party or the other. I think that redistricting in New Hampshire mostly is driven by the basic math and the underlying rules, the other rules that our Constitution has. For instance, the need that districts be contiguous. They have to be a single whole.
And you can't have a donut, like Wendy said.
Right, yeah. There's no donuts, and you can't divide a town or a city ward drives the overwhelming majority of the decisions that have to be made in redistricting. So you take some of the big southern towns like Derry or Salem, or these big towns are already going to be more than half of a Senate district, which is probably, in the next census, will probably be about 55,000 people. Derry has 35,000 or 34,000 people in it just to start. And then you have to find a town that borders it that gets you close to the ideal 55,000 without going over. And as soon as you start doing that with one town or another, you find there's actually a pretty limited amount of running room to make the kind of changes that lead to extreme gerrymandering cases like you see in some other states.
So there's mathematical restrictions on what you can do sometimes if you have to stick to that 55,000 number.
That's right. Math is the first restriction, because the very first goal in any redistricting plan has to be substantial equality in the numbers of people in each district. That's the first target in every redistricting.
Representative Smith just told us basically that her experience in the redistricting process after the 2000 census was the worst experience she's ever had. You were involved in that process too. How do you feel about it?
Well, I was involved in the process from a different perspective. I wasn't a party to any of the meetings that Representative Smith was in the House. But I ended up representing the Senate president in litigation, or the Senate, I'm sorry, in litigation in the New Hampshire Supreme Court. In 2002, Governor Shaheen vetoed the plan that passed the House and the Senate, and the legislature was unable to override her veto, and there was no ability to come up with a plan that addressed the unequal population that had developed in the preceding 10 years. So the case was decided by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ended up redistricting the state, which I don't think they want to do, and I know the legislature doesn't want them to do, but at the end of the day, if you can't come to an agreement, somebody's got to do it, and at that point, it was the Supreme Court.
I definitely want to ask both of you about some of the constitutional principles at play that you mentioned, Rick, and definitely get your take, Representative Smith. But let me remind our listeners that you can join us. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we are looking at who gets to draw the political boundaries here in the state and the particulars of a bill that would give most of the job over to an independent commission. Again, we'd like your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, before the show, I got lots and lots and lots of emails. I want to share a couple with you. Robert on Facebook says, In a time of too little bipartisanship, HB 706, that's your bill, Representative Smith, represents a strong bipartisan effort in the House and Senate to craft a good bill that strives to be fair to both parties and the voters, all of whom want their voices heard equally on Election Day. Robert says, why are some Republican members of the House and Senate still so steadfastly against this bipartisan bill to the extent that they are pressuring Republican colleagues not to support it? Voters want cooperation between parties and fairness in the next redistricting. Claudia in Concord sent us an email. She talks about the Constitution. She says the New Hampshire Constitution requires the legislature to draw the districts. And with HB 706, a commission will draw the districts, which are subject to legislative approval as required by the state constitution. The legislature's constitutional duty, Claudia says, will be fulfilled that way. Is that right, Representative Smith? So the legislature still has a role to play here if your bill becomes law.
If my bill becomes law, and I have every reason to hope that it will, that what Claudia says is correct, and she only tells half the story. We have to begin at the start of the process in which we have a system, and you have to listen carefully now because it's a little complicated, but the system in which we have the majority leader of the House and the Senate and the minority leader of the House and the Senate involved in the process of deciding who is going to be on the commission. And a list is drawn up of minority and majority, and then of 10 people on each. Then the minority leaders get to remove 5 names on the majority list and vice versa, so that we're constantly having checks and balances to make sure that we do what we can to balance. When I submitted the bill, it was the best bill I could come up with. I tried to see what happened in other states and how it worked and how it didn't work. And I submitted it to the House Election Law Committee, which made wonderful changes. And the committee passed the bill unanimously, then went to the floor of the House, went to the Senate, and there I worked very closely with the Republican leadership in the on the Senate Election Law Committee, and we made even more significant changes, having listened to the concerns and listened to some of the points that Rick just made and incorporated them into a bill which I believe does everything possible to do to include the legislature at the start of the process and at the end of the process and in the middle, have a competent group of people working in the public eye, not behind closed doors, but in the public eye with hearings in each county and whatever to make sure that we end up with the best possible redistricting.
So it has gone through several iterations, as you described, trying to get the legislature more involved, trying to, sounds like Representative Smith, have each of the parties kind of keeping an eye on who is going to be on this commission. How do you feel about this bill in its newer form, Rick?
I think Representative Smith has done yeoman's work on this. She really has put in a lot of time and effort and talked to anybody who had concerns about it. And 2 members of the Senate Election Law Committee, Senator Jim Gray and Regina Birdsell, both spent a lot of time in a room with Representative Smith going over the details. And I think it's gotten to a point where certainly the concerns I had about the constitutionality of some of the provisions have been addressed, and it's probably a worthy experiment and worth trying to see how it works.
So the bringing in the legislature at the end, as Claudia says, makes you feel better about the constitutional aspects of this, Rick?
Yes, that was one of my primary concerns when the bill came out of the House and the one that was introduced in the Senate as well, was that if the legislature didn't act on a redistricting plan approved by a commission, it would become law anyway. And where the Constitution requires the legislature to pass the law that becomes the act, I thought that that was a problem. Representative Smith and I have spoken about it and come up. There's language that the senators all got together with Representative Smith and seem to have come up with something that's going to work. So the advisory committee will be offer an advisory plan for the legislature to consider, and hopefully it'll be a plan that people can agree on. It's hard to know what's going to happen, but it's going to be worth finding out.
Well, we never thought in 2000 that it would end up in the state Supreme Court, so I definitely appreciate what you're saying. Here's an email from Fred in Canterbury who says, doesn't the independent commission bill still leave the last word with legislative leadership? Answer is yes. And finally, the courts. Fred asks, would it take a constitutional amendment to make the commission have the final word? Representative Smith, do you need a constitutional amendment to make this happen, or do you just need a bill?
Well,
a regular old bill with a law.
We only need a regular bill to have this happen. If, for example, we put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2020, by the time that passed and then subsequent legislation passed, it would mean we'd be ready to work on this after the 2030 census. We're concerned about 2020. So we could have a constitutional amendment, a simple constitutional amendment that establishes a redistricting commission. That's all it would have to do. But we don't need that in order to do what we're hoping to do after the next census.
What do you think, Rick? Do we need a constitutional amendment to make this sort of ironclad, to make sure we're following the rule and letter and spirit of the law or not?
You don't need a constitutional amendment to have an independent redistricting commission that makes a proposal for the legislature to take up. You would need an amendment to the Constitution in order for the redistricting commission's work to become law without further legislative action. So there would have to be an amendment that delegates the legislature's or changes the legislature's authority to redistricting and puts it with an independent commission.
Given how difficult this issue is, and both of you have experience with this, what do you think, Rick? What happens if this special commission comes up with a plan and the legislature says, uh-uh?
Well, the whole point of the way the legislature works is that there's accountability. And if people think that the commission came up with a good plan and the legislature rejects it, then they're going to have to live with the consequences of that, and that's as it should be. If the commission is either unable to come up with something or comes up with something that has some readily observable flaws in it, then the legislature will do its responsibility and attempt to fix the commission's suggestions.
That's the transparency that everybody keeps talking about. Go ahead, Representative Smith.
Well, there's another factor in the bill as it stands now, and the hope is that the court never has to get involved in this. But there are provisions for the court to get involved, and a citizen can bring that to the Supreme Court.
A citizen can bring it if he or she doesn't like the way the plan looks.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I want to pick up on that after a short break. Also ask you both a little bit more about who might be on this commission. And we have lots of listeners who want to jump into our conversation. So you can join us with an email exchange at nhpr.org or give us a call 1-800-892-6477.
Gift to NHPR through your estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave for those who will need a trusted source for news. Hi, I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major and Plan Gifts for NHPR. As NHPR has inspired you to learn more about your state and your world, so too will your legacy gift inspire future generations. Email me at salger@nhpr.org to learn more about including NHPR in your estate plans, or go to nhpr.giftplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Before we return to our conversation about redistricting, we'd like your help with our upcoming series on workforce shortages. Go to nhpr.org/exchange to submit your stories, questions, and experiences with labor shortages here in the Granite State. Also, your thoughts on how the state could create a more robust workforce. Again, nhpr.org/exchange to submit your comments, or you can just send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Back to our conversation now about redistricting and whether an independent commission should draw the lines that determine our political boundaries here in New Hampshire. Let us know what you think. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Rick Lehman is with us in studio. He's a lawyer in Manchester. He has served several times around as the legal counsel to the New Hampshire Senate during redistricting. Also with us, Marjorie Smith, Democratic state rep from Durham, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and she's the sponsor of the bill we're looking at, HB 706, to establish an independent redistricting commission. And both of you, right back to our listeners, and Yuri is calling in. Hi, Yuri, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Hello. Yes, my name is Yuri Rudensky, and I'm a redistricting attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. And the Brennan Center is a nonpartisan law and policy institute that works to improve our nation's systems of democracy and justice. And redistricting reform is really central to that mission because, indeed, our whole democratic system builds off of the choices that whoever draws our political maps make every 10 years. And the way we study and think about redistricting, and we really have looked at all 50 states and considered what has worked and what hasn't worked in all the quirks and different ways that different places do it. And we recognize that there's no one-size-fits-all approach, that there are certain values that redistricting should try to advance.
And, such as, Yuri.
The first one is independence, and that means building in a buffer from partisan politics. And we think that this advisory commission does a really nice job of that, leaving some role for legislators to play both on the front end and the back end, while making sure that the people who are serving are not themselves the direct beneficiaries of how districts are drawn. Second, the process should be driven by inclusivity and compromise. It's important to make sure that the range of voices that are present in a particular state are represented, and that those voices come together to find something that works for everyone, that people aren't going to be left with a system that shuts them out categorically, and that each set of views has the ability to ultimately carry the day. And in order for this to happen, there have to be clear rules, which I think HB 706 has. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, there's got to be public involvement and transparency. And I think this is really the strongest part of the bill. Again, having done this work for a while and watched the process play out in a number of different states, I think it's really speaks to the strength of the policy, just how broad of a range of stakeholders that has participated.
Okay.
There have been Republican senators, and it's something that we're excited to be supporting.
Well, Yuri, thank you for calling in. Good to hear from someone who's working on this nationally. So, Representative Smith, a big pat on the back for your bill. I'm interested in what he said about principles. You know, looking over the material, it does seem like there are three or four really key principles that people want to make sure are at play here. One is one person, one vote, communities of interest. What principles do you think are most important, Representative Smith? And Rick, I want to hear from you, too, on this.
Well, the bill lays out a few. Of course, one person, one vote is not an option. It is something that we must have in order to honor the United States Constitution and the state constitution. But there are other issues about communities of interest that I think are terribly important. And whether that's racial, ethnic, economic, social, cultural, geographic, or historic, those are important identities that must be recognized. When the South Carolina expert was brought in 2000 to draw lines, he created districts in the House. The Senate and the House are very different, as Rick has indicated, because there are 400 of us in the House, and it's you can have
multi-member districts.
Yeah. But I mean, there were districts where there were no roads between one town and another. Currently, Representative Ned Gordon has a district like that where I think he has five towns. One of them isn't really connected to anything else. That's an example of a community of interest that must really be honored. And we used language that was used at NCSL talked about trying not to unduly favor or disfavor a political party or a candidate. That, too, is very, very important.
Communities of interest, Rick, as someone who's been involved in this process, how do you define or interpret that principle? It seems like people could be members of several communities of interest.
Well, we're all parts of lots of communities of interest. But for redistricting purposes, I would say the most important single one is what political subdivisions we're part of. Town, which is mandatory. County, which in the House is very important because House members are members of county delegations, too, so they can't have a district that sits in two counties or that creates problem. So as long as we stick to political boundaries, I think that that is a community of interest that has to be first and foremost. I get concerned when we start asking people to create communities of interest around racial or ethnic lines. We don't have a very strong, we don't have a proud history of that in our country. We've done some things that our country cannot be proud of in our past, and I think we've done better now. And I think that in New Hampshire, which is 96% Caucasian, we don't really have an opportunity to create a majority minority district anyway that I can see. So I have some concern about that, but I hope people use good judgment thinking about those things. But certainly a community of interest could be virtually anything. It could be people who share a water system. It could be people who share a school district. It could be people who have the same employer.
And so could it be a judgment call at some point, or should it be more specifically Concord is Concord, Hopkinton is Hopkinton, Bow is Bow? I mean, because then you run into the mathematical problem that you talked about before. So I just wonder if community of interest is subjective.
Community of interest requires judgment calls, and that's for all the talk about mathematics and the cases in the Supreme Court that are talking about complex mathematic formulas and ways of analyzing data. At the end of the day, legislators exercise judgment and have to balance competing communities of interest and competing interests of their constituents.
What do you think, Representative Smith? Communities of interest, what's the best way to define that?
I don't think there's an easy way to define it, and that's why it's written in the bill as it is, that there are many factors that should be considered. That doesn't mean that they are binding except for a few core principles, and that is, in the House, we can't cross county lines. We respect the integrity of town and city lines. Those things are quite solid in terms of it. You can look and see if those are being honored. The others are just advisory to the commission to say, think about what you're doing when you draw. Think about, when you build a wall, think about who you're walling in and walling out. And that is an awfully good New Hampshire principle that we ought to honor.
Sounds like Robert Frost.
It certainly does.
Something.
It certainly does.
Let's go back to our listeners. Bob in Stratford says, for those concerned about the legislature's role in creating districts, the amendment to HB 706 is clear. And Bob puts this in bold letters. In the event the legislature cannot reach a plan and the court becomes involved, nothing in this section shall prevent a subsequent legislature from enacting an otherwise lawful redistricting plan. Bob says the quotation above is consistent with the fact that one legislature cannot bind another. Any redistricting plan created by an independent redistricting commission is advisory to the legislature only. I'm going to have both of you clarify that because I think it's an important point. Go ahead, Rick, you first.
Well, I think Bob makes good points in the email. Certainly, one of my original concerns with the way the bill came out of the House was that it purported to put a deadline on the next legislature's consideration of the redistricting commission's plan or whatever redistricting plan the legislature wants to come up with. People who are conservative like me have often thought it would be nice to impose a two-thirds supermajority before taxes can be raised. But you can't do that because each legislature gets to define its own rules, how they see fit. And this group that's in now can't dictate to the next group how they're going to go about doing the people's business.
So isn't the process, though, by law established every 10 years, Rick? So, you know, this legislature that's around for the process, they just sort of win the lottery, like it's their turn and that's it. I guess I don't understand how that could be, why it's problematic that that would be binding on the next legislature.
The way the bill was originally crafted basically said if the legislature doesn't adopt the, first of all, the legislature had to take up the redistricting commission's bill first. Second, if it didn't pass something by February 15th, then the redistricting commission bills would go forward.
I see.
Those were concerns that I had about the constitutionality of it because the next legislature has an absolute open playing field and can operate under whatever rules they want. So to the extent you say maybe they won the lottery, that's true a little bit. Each new group can make its own rules, and that's part of the Constitution too. It's expressly set out that the rules of proceeding in each house are strictly their business.
So that concern has been taken care of, though? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In the work that...
We believe that that has been taken care of, and it remains to be seen, since there is always the possibility of a suit being brought to the courts challenging what has been done and why it has been done. We must redistrict every 10 years. That is not an option. After the decennial census, we must redistrict. What happens after that is a little more fuzzy or
that's
gray.
That's what our emailer is asking about, yeah.
If you read the papers in recent weeks, you will see in a number of states, redistricting lines have been thrown out and the legislatures have been directed to come up with new lines that would apply only for the next election.
Oh, boy.
Because
so you have to keep doing this over and over
that's
again?
That's right. Because then after the 2000 census, they're going to have to do it all over again. So
that
the courts
seem advisable.
The courts felt pretty strongly about the districts that were drawn. One would have hoped that this might have happened a little earlier in the decade. But it happens when it happens.
That's a hard scenario for me to even imagine. Redistricting every 2 years? That sounds kind of like a nightmare.
Well, it's not necessarily every 2 years. It's
but
just as the result
like it.
It's as the result of a court decision that rules out
I see.
The existing district lines.
Rick, do you want to jump in?
Yes. We've addressed this in New Hampshire in the last round of redistricting. The Supreme Court, our state Supreme Court, has said that the legislature gets to do it once every decade. If districts have to be drawn by the court, the next legislature can come in and take a shot at it.
I see.
The court districts will be in place until the legislature changes them, but they can't go and do it every year. Our court has said that the constitutional command to do it every 10 years means you get to do it once every 10 years.
Okay. Well, it's confusing. Thank you for clarifying that. I do have one last quick question to ask both of you. Representative Smith, you first. Looking at the bill, it seemed like there were a lot of restrictions as to who could not be on it. No one who's recently been a candidate for elective office, has worked for a party or a political campaign, has worked for a lobbyist. There are other restrictions. And I was looking at these, Representative Smith, and I thought, wow, you could potentially be knocking out a lot of people with valuable insight. And I wonder what you think about that.
I think those people with valuable insight have any number of opportunities in the public context to say to the commission, have you thought about this?
In the
have
public
you thought about
process.
That? But all of this process is to be public. The idea is to try to find people without obvious and immediate commitments to one party or the other. And there are a lot of wonderful people in the state of New Hampshire who would qualify for that.
Could Rick be on the commission?
I think I would qualify to be on the commission.
Because you can't have worked for a political party. You were legal counsel to the Senate when the Senate was in Republican hands, but that's not the same thing as working for a party.
I think that's right. And the reason the selection process is set up the way it is so that people can be ruled out by the opposing party. And so there will be – my take on this, and I'm sure that a lot of your emailers and callers are here saying, let's get the politics out of redistricting. And my feeling about it is you can't. It's an inherently political process. What Representative Smith's bill is trying to do, in my view, is replace the politics and displace them and put some other form of politics in place. But those politics are going to be there. People are going to seek to maximize their situation, and I don't think there's any way to take that part of human nature out of the process. So the best you can do, and I think Representative Smith has done a very good job, is try to contain it, check it, have checks and balances, and create opportunities for people to come to agreement.
So prediction time. What's going to happen, Representative Smith, with this bill? What do you think?
I believe this bill is going to pass the Senate Election Law Committee, I hope unanimously, pass the Senate with a very strong vote. And I believe that the governor, looking at the progress that we have made, will see his way clear not to interfere with this becoming law.
What do you think, Rick?
I've learned about predictions the hard way. I think that this bill is really, it is a worthy experiment. It'll be interesting to see if it can help. If it passes, it might provide a really good start for the next legislature. It might provide the absolute redistricting plan. If it comes up with something that legislators don't like, they can start over. And so I think it's worth a try.
So, and it's interesting because you started out having some real concerns about this bill, and it sounds like some of the changes have made you feel a little bit better.
Well, my concerns about it were really constitutional in structure, and I feel like those have been addressed.
Okay. We'll see what happens. Thank you both very much for coming in and explaining this to me and our listeners. It's complicated. I really appreciate your time. Representative Smith, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That's Marjorie Smith, Democratic representative from Durham, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, sponsor of the bill we talked about, HB 706. Rick Layman, good to see you too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Rick Layman is a lawyer in Manchester who served as legal counsel to the New Hampshire Senate for two redistricting processes in 2001 to 2005 and again in 2010 to 2018. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.